Welcome to the Legendarium Green Team Podcast, a spinoff of the Legendarium Podcast. With me today is Chesky.
Heyo.
And Kipton.
Heyo.
And I am Era. Today we're starting the Dragaera cycle by Stephen Brust. The first book in the series is Jurig. Brust is a personal favorite of mine, which we can get into as we go into the podcast. Guys, I'd first like to ask you, what were your general thoughts about Jurig?
I thought it was well written, and as long as I sat back and let Brust guide me where he wanted to go, I had a good time.
Chesky?
Yes, I have to confess that I, in my mind, for some reason, had confused or conflated Stephen Brust and Michael Moorcock as the same person. I don't know why, it's just in my mind. So whenever I think of Taltos, I also in my mind thought of Elric, right? And so in my mind, I was expecting something a little different at the beginning. Like, I knew that Jurig was kind of more about dark fantasy, or he's the kind of the first real gritty type of fantasy. But so I really liked reading this book, actually. I had a lot of fun with it. It was super enjoyable, and I'm both ashamed and embarrassed that I hadn't read this before, because it's just that good.
Oh, that's nice. Yeah. So it wasn't actually Brust's first book. I want to say it's his third book. He wrote a couple other books before this one, but it feels to me pretty much like a first book. I don't know if that was y'all's impression as well.
No, this doesn't feel like a first book to me. This feels like someone who's been playing around for a while.
Well, there is that. He does like to play with his words, right?
Yeah.
But really, before we get into the book itself, I think it'd be fun to kind of situate our listeners, because I really do think context is important. So this book was written in 1983, and the series is still ongoing. He's expected to wrap it up pretty soon. But the series itself is 40 years old. So I thought it would be fun to do a quick time capsule before we start each book. So here's what else was going on in 1983.
I love this idea.
So in 1983, the Oscar winner is Gandhi. I don't even remember that, movie, guys.
That was a thing.
Yeah. But the number one domestic box office movie, Return of the Jedi.
Ooh, nice.
So that's nice, but guys, you weren't even born.
No, I was not born. Right? I was not born.
I mean, yeah. Right?
I wasn't even a twinkle yet.
I mean, Jabba the Hutt was a thing on everybody's lunchboxes back then. So the number one song, Every Breath You Take by The Police, which everybody thought was a love song back then. Really not a love song, guys.
God, my dad was having a great time in 1983, I'm sure.
So, for us book people, here's what I think is interesting. So, the Hugo Award for 1983, the nominees were Pride of Chonner, 2010, Odyssey, Friday, Courtship Rite, and Sword of the Lictor. Oh, and Foundation's Edge. Sword of the Lictor, by the way, is the first book of, or the first or second book in the New Earth series by Gene Wolfe, just for context. Anyways, and the winner was Foundation's Edge.
That's terrible. So, terrible.
It was really not a good book, was it?
No.
I didn't like it. No.
No. Golan Trevees is not an interesting main character.
I wouldn't have given it to, out of those, probably Sword of the Lictor, but that was hard to read. So, anyways.
There we go.
Yeah.
And then we also had Nebula Award winners. So the Nebula Award nominees were Startide Rising, Tea with the Black Dragon, The Void Captain's Tale, Lioness, and Citadel of the Autark. So Citadel of the Autark, again, is a continuation of Books of the New Earth.
Yep.
The Nebula Award winner was, drum roll please, Kip, it's your book, Startide Rising. Which I think is interesting because, you have Startide Rising kind of coming out the same year the Lioness.
I'll take Startide Rising over this book for sure.
So I was about to say, it seems like it's on a knife's edge for you, Kip, really, right?
Brust has some lovely prose, but Bryn had way more ideas in there.
Well, I think we all know our feelings on Startide Rising. If anyone wants to listen to it, we have a podcast about the entire series.
Yeah.
So a quick recap of the series, of this book, and I'll make it a very quick recap. Vlad Taltos is a human mafia boss living in an elven empire. His side gig is assassination. His companions include a smart a flying reptile called Loyash, his wife slash better half in almost every aspect, Kati, an arrogant elven noble, Morlin, Morlin's creepy psychopathic cousin, Illyra, and others. Taltos is hired by his mafia bosses to kill a renegade member, Melar. The case gets increasingly complicated when Taltos figures out that the renegade is trying to bring down two noble houses at one time through his assassination. Taltos figures out a way to kill Melar, save his friends, not start a war, keep his skin intact, and make a lot of money. So, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
I think it's lovely to have such a practical protagonist for once. But yeah. And not completely so. He's not a man without a moral code, but he is definitely a man who has a very unique and personal one, while still remaining economically and financially savvy.
So talk to us a little bit about that. I mean, you're right, he is practical, but I would also say he's got a pretty large temper that he keeps under wraps. That was my impression.
Yeah, definitely. He's a man who feels his past in every moment, which is fun.
Yeah. Chesky?
Well, something I really like. I like to recap. It's very good. But I also liked, as I was reading, just the realness to it, that yes, he's an assassin, and yes, people have tried to kill him before, but you know, when somebody tries to kill him in this book, he still has to go through his little ritual. He has to stare at a wall for 4 hours, and then he has to like shuffle home in a daze for 2 hours, and then his wife cooks him a meal, and she just is like, okay, you're going through something. I just felt, it felt really like he's not just, oh yeah, somebody tried to kill me and I'm just whatever, I'm over it, I'm gonna get, you know, he just felt more involved or more realistic to me than just, oh, I can get past anything, I'm fine, I'm the main character, I got to do my next thing. And I liked that he was always figuring stuff out, and it was never at, like, too fast of a pace or too slow of a pace for me, where he's like, okay, I figured this out about him, and then, you know, we wait a little bit, and then we figure out the next piece of the puzzle, and then we kind of do another couple steps in the next piece. And so it was never like, oh, here's six pieces of the puzzle I just pulled out of nowhere, and now I figured it all out, and then we have to catch up. We're really figuring it out kind of at the same time. Then obviously he's a little faster than us at it, but I felt it was still really well kind of threaded. And yeah, exactly.
He has the advantage of being able to think for hours in a couple sentences.
Yeah.
And I do like that the author allows a character to actually have like contemplation, complete it, and then move to action.
That is true. Cause he does have like large gaps of time, kind of like to just put into the story where, you know, I went to the play with my wife, had a nice dinner, came back the next day. So in a couple sentences, to both of your points, he's already moved the story forward like 17 hours before you get to the next action point in the book. So, so he definitely does gloss over kind of like the day-to-day activities, which I still find that's my personal preference versus the more modern day books where you kind of get a day-by-day blow of a person's life in the story. So,
yeah,
but that's more of a,
and they need to fill all those days and every hour of the day with uncommon events that interrupt things and move the journey along. No, sometimes you can just have a day with your wife, have a meal, and think over your current work problem.
Yeah.
I was going to say, I loved just like the start that he would have in his book, because it's as if Lot is telling you this story of what happened, right? Because he's always kind of addressing and saying like, oh, this happened. And like his attitude while he's telling you is just hilarious. And the one part that just kept reminding me of is just he's eating dinner after he's had this attempt on him. And he's just like, yeah, you know, my wife, bless her heart, made a meal so bland and so boring that I didn't even like think to compliment her to break me out of my, my stew. And he's like, you know, bless her for that. And it's like, is he being jokey? Like, man, it was so boring and bad, like, or just like bland that it was, you know, or was it like actually a good thing? You know, it was fun. That's that part was like,
I lean towards funny, joke, right? There.
So do I. Yeah. But it's just like, you know, the way it comes across is just like,
yeah,
you could take it either way.
One thing I don't want to spoil this for you guys for the rest of the series, but Rust loves his food and loves to talk about food and describe it. So if you like the descriptions of food, you're going to get a lot of food references throughout the course of the series.
I did think it was fun that he like basically owns a diner.
Yeah.
Not sure.
look, this is about as soft a magic as you're going to get. And he has three or four kinds of soft magic in the series. And I know I have Mr. Hard Magic here with me, Kip, and just you kind of leans more towards the hard magic. How do you feel about the magic systems here?
I'm fighting back on this label of Mr. Hard Magic. Hard magic, but like, come on, Tamora Pierce is not hard magic.
Well, true, Mr. Brandon Sanderson, but I mean, let's call a spade a spade. I mean, like, you,
sure, if you had a choice, supporter of Brandon Sanderson in this server. No, if I have a choice, I go towards science fiction, which has harder elements to it. Absolutely true, but. I thought this is a great example of actual thematic magic, where the use of it is well built into the story and the world. Most people seem to understand how things work, what's possible with it, what's not possible with it, ways to get around things like pesky resurrection spells. It seems well lived in and well conceived.
So, Chesky?
Yeah. No, I liked it. I thought he fleshes out enough that what he does do with it makes it seem possible. Obviously, we go on spoiler. We try to keep it a little more non-spoilery.
No, you can absolutely. I think it's spoilery at this point. And
it's only a 40-year-old book, right?
It's only a 40-year-old book. If you haven't read it yet, then shame on you. I will.
I know, it's
my 9-day. So
40-year-old almost novella. Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's like the witchcraft was fun. It kind of just gave you a. He gave you kind of like a little quick guideline about everything, and then he said, you know, run off with it. You know, witchcraft is slow but ritualistic and does weird things and simple things, and psionics is obviously, you know, just kind of psychic, and then sorcery is like, hey, I pull the magic, I do what I want, it figures all the hard stuff out. And it was fun and nice and simple, you know, and then this is a little more complicated with, like, Morganti weapons and then great weapons, and, you know, but it never felt... It never felt like out of nowhere or like, oh, yeah, well, of course he can just do that. Of course. Like, why wouldn't he be able to pull something out like that at the last second? No, like it all felt planned and well laid. Yeah.
Felt like very classic sword and sorcery magic and not the lazy kind.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would push back just a little bit on that, only in that this is one of the first books that I can remember that's an example of more talking about just the magic, like the elven magic as technology. It's like, it's just built into the day-to-day lives of these people. Like, I want to check the time. You kind of like look, you kind of check in with the orb and you have the time. You want to not get hit with water because it's raining. You kind of make a little umbrella spill above you. So to your points about it kind of being built into the world and stuff, this is one of the first books that I really remember distinctly where the magic was just built into the day-to-day lives of the people. So I don't know. And maybe that's just something you guys didn't notice because you see that all the time now, right?
It's one of my criteria for does the magic work in a book. And it's has the world correctly adapted to things that are like just obviously possible with it. And obviously this book passes that test.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So one thing, Chesky, you mentioned earlier that I thought was interesting is you talked about how the book never got ahead of the readers in terms of revealing like parts of the story. I also thought that one of the strengths of the book in that aspect was the world building was paced out with those revelations. Or I don't know if you guys had a different feeling than that.
Yes, I had a very different feeling about that.
There's one part of the story I'm deliberately not talking about yet. So take that part of the story, put it to the side, setting apart that one part of
lovely.
The story.
It was fantastic.
So we will. There's an elephant in the room that we will address, but let's let the elephant sit there and eat his hay right now. It's cool. Okay.
All right.
So, okay, I'm still ignoring the elephant, Kip. I'm not talking about it yet.
Okay. Yeah, no, absolutely. I loved the slow realization that you get that resurrection is possible and commonplace in this world. That was great. And I love the idea that these people are hybrids of animals and dragons and humans. And there's all these combinations and the social stigma around them becomes fairly rapidly apparent, but the complexity is revealed over time. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I thought that the pacing of those revelations and world building was pretty good, except for the elephant.
The elephant. I'm not talking about it. No, I'm still not talking about it. Chesky, you talk about anything but the elephant, Chesky. So.
Well, I'm not even sure what the elephant is for you guys, because I just liked it all. So. I'm not even guessing what I think it is, and I'll try to avoid that. But
I liked it. I just think it's very prominent.
It was
an exception.
Yeah, no, we're talking about it's like, hey, look, you know, you're eating like this wonderful dinner. It's just fantastic. And you're in the middle of dinner, and then somebody drops like dessert in the middle of dinner. You're like, what is this dessert doing in the middle of dinner? Like, we're not done with dinner yet. And
and then this year, have a whole bundt cake.
No.
Fine. Okay. Look, you know what? Enough. Okay. We'll talk about it. So,
Let's talk about Chesky.
Here's your point. God.
Well, I don't even know what my point was supposed to be. I totally forgot, but I was going to say something about I like that, you know, at the beginning, I was like, okay, I got Dragaerans and I got humans. And then, you know, we learn a bit more, oh, they're divided into houses, and then we have a council, and then we learn, okay, they really are based on these animals, and then more than that, they're, you know, actual descendants of animal, not animals, but, you know, they're the hybrids genetically, and then we learn more and more. And then it was nice that it actually played a part in the story. Like, it wasn't just, oh, yeah, of course, we're all descended from these animals, the Dejurs and the Leorns and this, but it's like, that actually factors into like why are our, you know, our bad guy is doing what he's doing and how he's doing it.
Right. So people can't see it, but you did bad guy in air quotes. Because I think that's appropriate because there are no good guys in this story. So
right. Well, we were following a mafia boss, right? Like
well, and that's what I thought was interesting, that Kip at the beginning talked about how practical Taltos was in the story. But we're talking about a guy who's like, yeah, kneecap this guy because he's not paying me my money, or like, you know, or it's a damn shame that guy fell down the steps 10 times and accidentally, like, you know, broke both of his legs in the process. Like, you know, it's practical like that, right? Mm-hmm.
Taltos is the assassin that people wish Fitz was.
You know what? That's
pretty good.
That's a fair point. That's a fair point. But look, if you ever want to know why, I personally am more of a fan of the shorter books. Like, I think, like, I would have to look at Stephen Brust as my avatar for that, because he packs quite a bit in what Kip says almost a novella-length novel. So, and he does that pretty consistently. So, anyways, for what it's worth. So, I'm still going to... Here's the way we're going to talk about the elephant, Kip. Do you guys, aside from Taltos, do you have any characters that stood out to you or that you found was a favorite character or least favorite? Either way.
Oh,
I'll let Chesky go first this time.
Yeah, it's hard to say which one I liked or didn't like. I liked what's his assistant's name?
Krager,
yeah. I liked Krager because he's just got that I'm not noticed and like I just do what I do. And he's just always so funny. He's like, oh, it's like, you know, Don Taltos gets to his office. He's like, I beat Krager one day, and this is going to be great. And then he sits there for a minute, and he looks at the chair, and he sees Krager. He's like, Krager's like, yeah, I've been here for like 10 minutes. You just didn't even notice when I walked in, you know, when you walked in. It's just so funny like that. And his wife was nice. I mean, she doesn't get a lot of screen time, but what part she does get was good. And I liked Morolan, where he's just like, no, I want to be, you know, I want this to be it is. Like, I'm not going to bend my principles. And I understood, you know, his kind of rules, but it would have made an easier book if he'd bent his principles. But that's what makes a good book, is like challenges and difficulties. So, yeah.
Kip?
I liked his buddies, Aliar and Sethra.
Yep.
I think that they had fascinatingly alien perspectives on things. And it's always fun untangling their different ideas of morality and ethics and propriety.
So Sethra, for anyone who hasn't read the book, is basically, for all intents and purposes, like a demigod, right?
I'd almost call her like a demon.
Explain.
Yeah.
Because she's like this primal force of nature that... has powers beyond the ken of most mortals, and remembers basically times of creation that are lost to humanity, but also works on a on a sense of morals, which is deeply opposed to that of like Earth baseline humanity. Like what would be considered as normal, natural, and moral to us as people?
Do you have an example you're thinking of?
Well, just her general disdain for mortals, and not even disdain, just indifference. Their concerns are fleeting at best to her. I don't know.
I'll disagree a little bit. I didn't think she felt that unattached to anybody, because she's pretty attached to Alira and Morolan, you know, because she could have just said, I'll let one of you kill each other, you know, because both of them are trying to, I'll be the one to die so that we could stop this war. And the other one's like, no, I'll be the one to die so we could stop this war. You'll kill me, and then I'll also solve the war, you know. And she stops them both. And I think she does see it as a foregone conclusion that the war's going to happen. You know, she does leave and go get ready for it. But now she was interesting because she didn't fit to me any of our established things, right? She's Dragaeran, but she's not, because she's lived 10,000, 20,000, 40,000 years since, you know, time immemorial, basically, for us.
Yep.
And so she's kind of just this, like, oddity, but yet there.
I literally can't say anything because I know so much more about her than just you right now. So, but
now you know how it feels to be on the
other
end. Yes,
I know. I know. It's awful. I don't know how you did this. Here's what I'll say. You are both right and you're both wrong. So there you go. Okay. I mean, yeah, you both had some really good insights on Sethra, I think. Here's my question to you. Why is Sethra friendly with Tautos in the first place? If she's that long lived and that indifferent to people, like, why is she interested in a guy who's going to live not even 100 years?
He's unusual.
Yeah, I would think it would have to potentially be because of his reincarnation status of who he was in the past, that he might be a fated, with the quotation marks there, fated soul that does interesting things whenever he comes around.
Wait, there's the elephant in the room.
Hold on, wait a minute. There's the elephant. Oh, there's the elephant. I'm sorry. So I was going to say, like, I've read this book, I don't know how many times, and like on this go around, it really stood out to me like a sore thumb, how there was Alira, like as a character throughout the book, and then there was, I don't know, Dream Alira, Miss Exposition, who kind of like word dumps an entire backstory. So Chesky's like, that's fine. Like, well, I don't know what the problem is.
Word dumps are great. That's how you get information across the fastest, right?
But I'm going to turn the floor over to Kip because he's been waiting for this.
Okay. Yeah.
There's
a novella in the middle of this book, and it should really have a warning. It really should, because it just takes over the storyline. We're dropped into this dream sequence thing, and we get a whole bunch of exposition and basically a prologue to the story in the middle. I feel like another author might just like leave a hint of that and then explore that later on in a sequel or something, and we'll have like a whole prequel novel or whatever, and we'll get hints that no, this person's resurrected soul is actually this person from way back that we've been building up as this like epic historical figure. But no, it's fine.
Says run with it, we're going full speed ahead.
Well,
it's not a badly written piece of exposition. It's just big.
It's a bun cake in the middle of dinner. So. Bun cake's delicious, but I wasn't ready for my bun cake.
I was not ready for it.
So yeah, it did stick out. It's you know, now that I guess we can almost read critically for a living, it really did stick out as a sore thumb. As just like, what are we doing with this, right? But really, it's well written for what it's worth.
Should there be a new cover page in a physical copy of the book?
No. What I'll say is, over the course of the rest of the series, you do get more information doled out about that portion, and it does integrate into the larger story as a whole, kind of, I think. So,
well, if there's ever a special illustrated copy of this book, that's definitely where one of the new illustrated pages needs to be. Now let's send children to a story of a people long ago.
No, but it is an interesting story, though. Go ahead, Chesky.
No, I just, like, when I was reading it, I didn't really notice it as such because I was just so engaged in reading. And then a little bit later, I was like, yeah, good. I read it super fast. It was just, I couldn't put it down, of course. But I was just like, you know, that was interesting and it was cool, but it wasn't quite as important as, like, the rest of the revelations, you know, pertaining this book. You know, maybe it's much more future important or something, but it's kind of like, that's really interesting. It doesn't really play a whole lot into why he needs to do things this book, aside from giving him a good, like, who are you, Shake? You know, are you this legendary figure that you, or are you, you know? And then he's able to figure it out, so.
Well, I agree, but at least to me, on just reading it, just kind of like pretending I was reading it for the first time in preparation for this with you guys, like, one of the things I liked about the story was how Stephen Bruss integrated the world building into the conversation pieces. And that made this piece, kind of where Alira kind of has this whole separate conversation with Taltos, that's what made it so jarring, because it was not woven into the story. It was literally like a rock plopped down into the middle of a pond. And so that was why it stood out to me. So, Kip, was that kind of your feeling, or did you have a different one?
I had the feeling that the revelation that the Jereg clan was not actually mixed with the Jereg creature was a more important revelation to the story.
Interesting.
And a much shorter one.
Interesting.
Because I think that more thematically links the protagonist as someone special by the fact that he is now bonded to Jeregs.
Interesting.
Something that was unthought of as possible, right? Because it's one familiar bond, not two.
That is interesting. So you guys have not mentioned my favorite non-Teltos character of the series. I do like Loyash, but it wasn't Loyash. Kadi. I think Kadi's great. And that maybe that's because I have foreknowledge. It's not a big revelation to let you know that she's a central part of books 2 and 3. So if you liked her a little bit now, you're going to get a lot more from the next two books.
It's not a spoiler to say that his wife is important to him in the next three books.
I mean, she seemed fun and interesting. I didn't feel like I fully had enough yet.
Yeah, well, you might have too much for by the end of the next two books. But
you told me that last time, and I didn't believe you.
Yeah, well, buckle up. Okay. So since we're talking about Kadi, one of the things, it almost don't recognize it anymore now, but this book was written in 1983. And aside from Taltos' relationship with Kadi, there was almost no mention of like gender or whatever with regards to the relative power structures of people in the books.
Seth, very little.
We talked about, she was female, all powerful. Alira was like one of the deadliest sorceresses in the world.
Yep.
Female, who cares, right? Like, so it was a feature. It was a feature of the person, but it didn't define the person.
Yeah. This world has come to terms with the fact that power equalizes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So, I just wondered from your perspective, Kip, you were saying you loved it. So I take it that it felt like a little bit more modern than some of the older books in some ways.
I mean, there's so much older sci-fi. We want to talk about Foundation's Edge and its treatment of women.
Asimov had a lot of good ideas.
You want to talk about a female character whose name is Bliss? Who functions merely as a remote to, no, I'm not getting into Foundation's Edge. I'm not going to talk about how the women in those stories are prostheses for the men.
Chesky, did you know how he says, I'm not going to talk about it?
It's the classic, I'm talking about it by not talking about it kind of formula there.
These characters are real. They are complete in and of themselves. They have actions. They have motives. They have fun quirks. They have divine demigod-like powers. they've got little meals that they make for their husbands, which don't interrupt their broodiness.
Broody time. Yeah. Oh, I thought it was surprisingly well, like, and like kept up its edge even through, you know, time. It's still good. You know, it's, there's been lots of other books that don't hold up to the test of time for, you know, going back and rereading them, and this one did.
This one definitely didn't give me any of those this is written in the 80s women flashbacks.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I've definitely become more sensitized to that over especially after having met you, Kip, and Chesky, that hey, this is weird. I'm like, no, it's not. And then I read it, I'm like, oh, I kind of see what they're saying now.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
So, but yeah, but like that's also why I wanted to do the time capsule in the beginning, because context is important, right? I mean, like, when the book is written does matter. At least I think so. I don't know if you guys have a different thought.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. No, I mean, talking about other books that were written in the 80s, Ethan of Athos, not a great book, but one of the very few that like tried to tackle the AIDS crisis.
Right. Yeah. Right. So we talked a little bit about the world building. Was there anything about the world building you found compelling or not compelling? Like, I'll give you a for example, for me, like, I like the fact that like, he kind of mentions it in passing how, you know, he hasn't explained it. He goes, like, I clapped at the door. So it becomes obvious that they don't knock on doors. They clap at the door. They clap their hands when they get near the door, right?
Star Trek.
Which I was like, I'm like, well, the doors don't open. Somebody still has to open the door, but they clap their hands instead of knocking on the door, right? That's just like a cultural custom he built into the world. But he doesn't explain it. He just goes, here, this is what they clap their hands. And you have to infer that they don't knock on the door.
Yeah.
So anyways, I thought that was like those little touches like that where he kind of just puts it into the story as the person did X without really explaining it. That, to me, I liked, because it was such a mundane thing that there was no reason for him to explain it. But it gave the world some flavor.
I'm very interested in the general state of science in this universe. That hasn't been really fleshed out a ton yet, but there's been enough mentions that there's clearly a lot going on behind the scenes that we haven't seen yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Yeah, they do throw out like, oh yeah, of course we know about genetics, but I used magic to get to it and not, you know, not science. It was just interesting. And yeah, I just thought it was all well woven in together, you know, so.
It will come as no shock to either one of you that one of Stephen Bruss' favorite authors is Roger Zelazny.
And what's the like real estate market for floating castles?
Hey,
it depends. Is there like an interregnum or not?
Well, so did you guys have a favorite scene, moment, person?
I can go with one of mine, yeah.
Yeah.
I like when he gets the notice that he needs to meet with the demon, and he's like, oh crap, the demon wants to meet with me. But he's like, but it's after noon, so it'll be okay. You know, and then he goes through his mind and he's just like, well, if I wanted to kill somebody, you know, and I invited them out to dinner, I would do it at this time, but he's doing it at this time, so that means, you know, okay, I'll only put three guards and like one of them somebody he knows so that like he feels comfortable, that like I'm feeling comfortable. It was just like it was just a funny scene where he's just like, oh crap, I'm gonna die. And then he's like, okay, well, let's think about it logically. And then, you know, and then he gets to the dinner, he's like, I sat with my back to the door, because at this point, if nobody notices me beforehand that he's here, I'm dead anyway if he's trying to kill me. Yeah, it was just, it felt fun and nice.
And that kind of thing could like easily be overdone and come off as real like edge material, but it sounded practical. The way that Brust has with words themselves really is able to let him do a bunch of situations that another author would just find way too clunky.
Mm-hmm.
That's a good point.
And that kind of internal monologue thinking about every possible situation is something that I've seen done in YA assassin novels horribly.
Yeah, give me the feeling of when I get called into my boss. I know I haven't done anything wrong, but I still go through these same steps when my boss calls me and is like, hey, let's have a meeting. And I'm like, oh crap, what did I do wrong this time? And how am I going to get out of it? And it's like, okay, wait, it's okay. Everything's going to be fine. Or when
you just get a calendar invite and there's no information attached. And you're like, what is this?
Yeah,
So you kind of come in all nervous and like with your bags half packed, like, hey, how are you doing?
So, and then you're like, oh, they're talking to everyone. Is this mass layoffs? Is this, or no, this is just like one-on-ones for quarterly assessment, whatever.
So, Kip, what about you? Did you have a favorite scene, moment, anything aside from the elephant? So,
I mean, I really did like the bundt cake. I love bundt cakes, but...
Yeah. It did make you, I don't know about you, but it made me stop and kind of actually had to get up and go walk around because it was just too much information, kind of like right then.
No, I sat through the whole thing and read it in one sitting.
It was a lot of information, though.
It was a lot of information, but I was in a good place. I was in a hammock out at the lake house, so like whatever. No, what I want to give credit for is the opening scene where Vlad talks about the first time he saw someone get killed in front of him as a child while he was working in food service, and he was like, "Wait, they're leaving without trying to pay. I need to stop them."
That was so funny.
and that whole little flashback, which it should have been a hint, was just about the idea that the feeling of a blade on the back of your neck feels the same as a cold wind. Mm-hmm. And this really introduces you quickly to the kind of man that Vlad is, and he's one who deals with the threat of death daily, and it no longer phases him. It's as common as the wind.
Yeah.
Except it does phase him. It doesn't, but it does. You know, when he has a serious attempt, it does him out, which is like, I agreed with what you said, though, 100%, though.
He has strategies in place, though, to manage that.
Yeah, exactly. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Which, like, it's not every day for him, but it is part of his life, and it's something that he feels and lives with at every moment. And he can't forget. That's... Like, as I said earlier, I really like that he's a man who's constantly living with his past, and Brust makes that come through in odd moments, like comparing a breeze to a murder attempt. Like, those things are linked for him, and they probably shouldn't be, but they are.
But they are. No, it's no, and that's a good catch. I didn't think about that. So I like that. But it does go part and parcel with the way he portrays Taltos' practicality on the one end with his kind of like emotion suppression on the other end, but which he lets come out kind of, to Chesky's point, in quiet moments away from people. Like whenever that happens, he'll do it in front of his wife. He'll kick Krager out of the office. And so yep. It'll either be him and Loyosh or him and Kadi, and that's it. And that's when he has his little mini meltdowns, because he always has to portray himself to the outer world as something else.
Mm-hmm. And Loyosh is a great animal companion. And again, what some people, I would imagine, wish Fitz was.
So, you mean Fitz or Night Eyes?
I mean the relationship between them, so whatever, both.
So, yeah, no, so that was going to be my next question for you guys. Animal companions. Yeah, I know you guys are big animal companion people in books.
Yeah.
Where does Loyosh rank for you right now?
Loyosh is a solid 4 for me right now. 4 out of 5. Four out of five.
Okay. Yeah, I think I'd put him right there, just a little. I don't know, he's like right middle of the pack / middle upper of the pack for me. Out of the ones I can think of off the top of my head. So
who would you say is a better animal companion than Loyosh?
I mean, Night Eyes.
Be careful what you say. Night Eyes. Come on, man. Come on.
Kip is just coming out of the gate swinging here.
I mean, come on.
It's very unfair of me to say that after one book, though. Very unfair.
Night Eyes is pretty cool. I do like Night Eyes, though. What about you, Chesky?
I don't know. It's hard for me to come up with specifics about which character companionship could be better. I only have one book experience in, because, you know, one book of here versus, you know, nine books of Cradle or nine books of, you know, 6 and Assassin's Apprentice and, you know, Fitz and stuff makes it hard to compare. But I do like him a lot. I love their attitude, you know, their, you know, best friends for life, but they're like, you suck. No, you suck. No, just listen to me and do what I said. No, I'm going to be silly and do over this. And okay, don't be an idiot. I'll go do that. Yeah, like, it's just, I like their relationship. It's a lot of fun. So
it's like, you never going to do this.
Yeah. I can't imagine how they make that into a TV show, right? With Loyosh. Because that's the most fun part of the book to me, is their conversations with each other.
So tough.
Voiceover work.
But anyway, so to me,
who would voice Loyash in a casting? Who would you pick?
Don't ask me these questions. I can barely think of actors when I can see their face. I can't picture. I can't do it without.
It would have to be somebody with who can go to a teenage voice. Hmm. Like a Tom Holland type of guy.
I wouldn't trust Tom Holland to voice act.
Okay.
That's a tough one.
That's a tough one. Yeah. Do you have a thought, Kip?
Oh, I don't have a thought. No, but I would probably, I'm thinking of anime voice actors now.
Okay. Well, while you're thinking, I'll tell you one of the things that I like.
The actor who I think would be hilarious in the role would be Tim Curry.
Oh my God.
Tim Curry's pretty funny in whatever he does. So
that would be hilarious. Or if you want to go against type, have like Ian McKellen kind of like do the voiceover for Loyash Gandalf. So, anyways,
at that point, just pick Gilbert Gottfried.
Yeah, now that's actually that reminds. Well, I just watched a TV show with my wife, and the voiceover was done by John McEnroe, which was like not expected. But anyways, one of my favorite, I think one of the favorite things I liked about the book, I can't really call it a scene or moment. I'll call it style, is the way Bruss structures conversations. Like the conversation to me in my mind always felt fast, like a pitter patter kind of going back and forth, mm-hmm. where there's always snappy comebacks kind of back and forth. So I like the way that's done. And I don't see a lot of authors able to do dialogue that way. And maybe that's just a me thing. I just haven't been exposed to it enough.
I think it's definitely high tier dialogue. I think it's high tier writing mm-hmm. in general, but yes. The pithiness is definitely a skill of Brust's.
Yeah.
And mm-hmm. I always enjoy that. And I enjoy adult conversations that are pithy, but also don't seem like, you know how film conversations, film telephone conversations are always just like straight, quick, to the point, and then they hang up.
Yep.
Mm-hmm.
Yep. I feel like there's a bit of that in this, but you don't notice it because it's written so well.
That's a good point. Good point.
Yeah.
Do you guys have any other scenes or moments you guys want to talk about?
No, I mean, I'm trying to think of something else that I really, really liked. I mean, I like the kind of starts and ends with the same thing where he's summoning a Zhereg. You know, at the beginning of the book is a prologue, is, you know, first the knife scene, then he goes on. He's like, well, this is the first thing of like real, real importance when I went out into the woods and I called a Zhereg. And then it ends with him fighting Melar and being like, well, I'm going to die unless I can do something really quick because, you know, he only beat 16 Dejure lords at once, you know, and like I can't beat one of them if I haven't planned it out. And but then he calls another, you know, Zhereg because he's in the same spot. He's like, hey, wait a minute, I could do that. And then, you know, he does. And so it was kind of a nice like bookends on the other side, like start with a Zhereg, end with a Zhereg.
Yes.
I mean, it's not the true beginning and true end, but like it's close enough.
I really do think that that summoning of a second Zhereg is something that is going to have repercussions down the line and really marking him out as someone special. But I hadn't really considered it as a mirror of like the first and most recent witchcraft things that he does, which is cool. Thanks for that, Chesky.
No, that's what I'm here for, is to provide deep and meaningful insight and definitely not just the punch in.
Well, I think the other thing I liked about this book, now that with perspective, this book was written 10 years before Goodfellas, 20 years before The Sopranos, and 15 to 20 years before urban fantasy became popular. And it's a mafia boss hitman in a city environment in an elven empire. So you have all that kind of in 1983 in this little itty bitty book that nobody seems to want to pay attention to. So I like that.
And a villain who's like a scion of two houses and hates it.
Yeah, and like a surprisingly well-developed villain. Like I was not expecting the villain to be as well-developed as he ended up being. Yeah. The way he was developed through the investigatory process.
I'm definitely interested in meeting more products of multiple houses and seeing how they maybe differ from this villain.
Well, so you got to my next question. Do you guys have any predictions or things you would like to see in upcoming books?
More hybrids.
more hybrids. Yeah.
No, I don't know. That's I feel like if he does more hybrids, it could kind of turn out the same. Not exactly the same, you know, because it's a du jour and a dragon, but it could be kind of a similar thought where it's just like, oh, he's caught between their two halves. But I think it would be fun too. I'm interested because I know that the names of the books, you know, coming out, they're all, not all of them, but I know there's like Leorn and Tekla and Salmouth. And so it's all the animals and the houses that I'm interested to see how that plays out. Like this one's Jereg, and we're learning a lot about being a Jereg, you know, and Vlad in general. So I'm curious, well, what's the next good book going to be about? What's Tekla going to be about? Is it about him solving a problem for the Tekla, or like having a Tekla bad guy, or, you know, kind of what's coming? I'm excited by that and just, you know, interested to see. So
I also just like the word Tekla.
Yeah. Yeah. They're pretty good words.
Some fun words. Some fun, yeah. 80s fantasy words in here. Yeah. Everything from the 80s was bad, and I throwing H's after J's is definitely one of them that I think is fun.
And for what it's worth, we've been pronouncing Taltos wrong. Stephen Twist would say it's Taltosh because it's Hungarian. So for what it's worth, I just need to make sure that gets said, because otherwise somebody's going to come in here and say, you're pronouncing it wrong. Yeah. I know I'm pronouncing it wrong. It's Taltosh.
So. Yeah. I listened to like 10 minutes of the audiobook, and then I was like, nope, it's just faster to read it. So I read it instead. But I did notice that it was Vlad Taltosh and Jereg with like a Z sound. Jereg. It was kind of, yeah. It was
Jereg.
Yeah, it was interesting. I was like, oh, okay, I like this, the way it's pronounced, but, you know.
So it's definitely like Hungarian / Eastern European. So the humans in this world, that's kind of like the pseudo-cultural vibe, for what it's worth.
Bring on the Hungarian.
So one last question that I'm going to let you guys go. What do you think about these action scenes compared to what you're used to nowadays? Because I know it's completely different. So I didn't know whether you liked it, didn't like it, liked parts of it, didn't like parts of it. So I'm genuinely interested kind of like in your thoughts, because, and I'm going to turn this over to Chesky first, the connoisseur of punching.
Yes, please.
kind of see what he thinks. So.
Yeah, I liked them. They weren't. It reminded me a little bit during some of his fight scenes where he's kind of fighting Sebastian de Castell's type of story or type of writing, where he's like, "I'm going to explain to you how this fight is going, and I'm going to try and explain it from like my fencer's perspective." Where he's like, "Okay, he's coming in with the overhand chop, so I have to parry, and then I have to, you know, but I'm trying to set up for this maneuver." I liked it. I thought it was fine. It wasn't like they fought and then they were done, right? And then I won, or you know what I mean? Like, it wasn't like so condensed and so like unimportant, but it wasn't so important that he spent too long on it. You know, he explains it in a quick, and it's got like movement behind the action, so you can kind of feel it and be like, oh, okay, he dodged, he stabbed, you know, he explained it enough that I could see it in my head without it being fully, you know, like he moved his sword 1 foot and then stabbed, and then he, you know, it all flowed together much better than others I've read sometimes. So,
yeah.
Chip, I know punching is not your style necessarily.
My thing, I admit I have a bit of a tendency to speed read at my fastest through combat scenes. But it wasn't that bad. I really don't like when we get the every like arm and foot and hand movement of the character during a combat scene. That's not my jam. This was a tolerable level below that.
Okay, good. No, hey, look, I'll take a win when I take a win. What's interesting is I won't spoil the book, but there's a book where he meticulously plans out an assassination, and then like Kipple like this part, it's done.
So. Awesome, amazing.
Hey, that is cool though.
Yeah.
Meticulously planning an assassination is cool, especially if it all goes right, you know, like that takes time and effort, and I love, like,
it can't happen every time, but it should happen sometimes.
Yeah. I liked his method. He's like, I observe the person for weeks if I have to. I know everything about them better than they know themselves, and then I killed him. You know? Yeah. It's like...
Vlad would have had no problems completing this assassination if he'd been given a month.
Absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah. No problems whatsoever.
Yeah.
Well, that was one of the things I did like about the character, is that the character is the master of wanting more information. It's like, more information is good. Why do I not want information? Yeah. It's foolish to not have information. So
one of my pet peeves is when a character decides they have enough information and new information comes in and they decide to like have breakfast or something instead of reading it. It's so annoying.
Well, that's funny. Let's find out what happens. So I'll say this. So every odd book is a step forward from in time from where Jarek is. So book one, book three is forward in time from Jarek. Okay. And book five is forward in time from book three. Every even book is a flashback.
Huh.
Yeah. So I've heard that before.
Yeah. So the second book is going to be a flashback to when he met his wife.
And they didn't decide to make the second book the flashback to
the foundation of the empire. is there any rhyme or reason to that?
Why did they go back to the empire?
is there any rhyme or reason to the flashbacks? Like the first one is like the farthest back, and then it goes a little closer, kind of building up to Shenek, or just kind of like. It's a flashback. Yes, no. It happens whenever.
I'm definitely going to guess there's going to be deeper stuff in the past than the wife.
Well, it could start like the most recent flashback and then go to the further back and then further back. Or I just was curious. So, and if it's a spoiler, don't tell me.
It's not a spoiler. But what I would say is the flashbacks are not connected to each other in time. In other words, they're not going from the furthest back forward. They kind of jump around in time.
I'm a fan of that.
They all the flashbacks tie in importantly to character developments that then you will see or observe in the next book, or it would have informed something that happened in the past. So every even book does this thing where it connects kind of both ends, both the previous book and the next book, all through a flashback. It's really interesting. I don't want to spoil it by it. Okay. You have to kind of experience it, but it's the first time you read it, you can just kind of blow by it and go, oh, that's fun. But then for me, after I've read it now a few times, I'm like, oh, crap, he actually planned A, B, C, D. That's really, really clever. So, but we could talk more about that on the next book. So
I'd rather have a thematic plan for flashbacks than a chronological one. I feel like a chronological plan for flashbacks is just, it's too scripted. And you have to execute it extremely well. And I don't know if there's many authors who are capable of that.
Well, we'll see if you think Bruce can do that. The one thing I do have to remind you, though.
I don't think he's attempting. I don't think he's not doing what Chesky said, which is do the flashbacks like first one's 10 years back, second one's 20 years back, then 30 or whatever. Yeah, no, that's just setting yourself up for, oh, like one of them is going to be disappointing because I needed to place it at this point in time. But really?
Yeah, or I forgot this really critical piece of information that happens at this time. And now I have to like lampshade it later in a different book and say like, oh, remember this thing that happened in the book that I totally didn't mention that didn't happen, but did for sure. You know, it can cause a lot of problems if you're not like super meticulous. So I'm glad to hear. I mean, it's either way, I was happy. So
no, I wasn't going to say about that.
Like I was not a fan of the way that Brandon Sanderson decided that he needed to make a certain character a flashback character in the Stormlight Archive, even though it wasn't particularly strong.
So the one thing to remember about flashbacks, and this is actually important, is that Vlad thinks in our scale of time. So when you flash back 10 years, he's a noticeably younger person and he will act in a noticeably younger way, right? Whereas Morlin is thousands of years old. So 10 years back is yesterday for him. So you will see, keep that in mind as you read the books, because some characters will stay static and some characters will have dramatic personality differences. And you have to think about it in terms of the scale of time that these characters are thinking in. So, if you're interested for background material, for what it's worth, you can always read his prequel series that is really unconnected in anything but the most tangential way to this series. It's called The Kavrin Romances and it is written as an homage to Alexandre Dumas. So it has nothing like this writing style. It's all written as overly flowery and super extra verbose. Still has a sense of humor, though. So if you want to give that a try while you're reading through the series, feel free.
Are they similar length to this one or longer?
No, much longer.
Okay.
So The first book in the Cavern Romances.
The Phoenix Guards.
Phoenix Guards, that's like almost 600 pages.
Okay, okay.
Yeah.
And do you think it works well as a standalone if you decide not to continue further?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes. So that's entirely your choice. And it's actually, you know what, if you do intend on reading it, here's what I'll tell you. If you intend on reading it, read it after book five, and I will explain to you that when we get to book five.
Maybe I will.
Let's look at this. The Aura has become the master of the read and find out here.
I've learned most of that from Aura.
I'm trying, guys. I'm doing my best.
You do great. I love it.
So, but anyways, let's find out on the next book how Kadi and Taltosh meet and manage to kill and not kill each other. So,
okay.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
All right, guys. Thank you for joining Legendarium Green Team Podcast, a spinoff of the Legendarium Podcast. We would like to thank Greg of the Legendarium for giving us this little corner of the internet to share, Horizon Brave for getting us started, and Galactic Damages for the music, Jingle Punks. Bye, guys.
Other way around, I think, for the music. Jingle Punks made Galactic Damages.
There you go. Whatever. This is why I don't post.
There's music and we like it. Thank you.
Goodbye, everyone.
Bye, guys.
Bye, guys. See ya.